from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In San Francisco, people who are extremely drunk on the streets are locked in jail and released once they sober up. Chronic offenders are often homeless. A new plan, supported by the mayor and a number of other city officials, could force them to stay in jail or choose mandatory treatment for up to 6 months. Critics worry it's a short-term solution to a complex problem and that it violates offenders' rights. We'll talk about it on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee and others support a plan tentatively being worked out by the city courts, the police, and the Department of Public Health to compel chronic drunks to be in treatment programs rather than out on the streets. Mandatory treatment for chronic drunkenness. Well, chronic drunks cost the city millions of dollars each year, and the proposed program would mean 5 days in contempt for each missed court appearance and up to 6 months of treatment. In this opening Forum Hour, we discuss the problem of chronic public inebriation, the proposed plan, and other possible ways of dealing with public drunkenness. Joining us in studio is Bevan Dufty, who's director of the Housing Opportunity Partnerships and Engagement in San Francisco. Welcome to the program, Bevan.
Thank you, Michael. Glad to be back.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Jeff Adachi back with us, public defender for the city and county of San Francisco since 2002. Welcome, Jeff.
Good morning, Michael.
And we'll say good morning to Joe Robinson, who's here with us as well, director of Community Behavioral Health Services for San Francisco's Department of Public Health. Welcome.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. And also glad to have Keith Humphreys, who's professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford School of Medicine. His research focuses on prevention and treatment of addictive disorders. He's also a research scientist at the VA Medical Center in Palo Alto and former senior policy advisor for the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. Welcome, Keith Humphreys.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. Bevan Dufty, let me begin with you, and let's talk about this program and what you envisage in it. I know you're in favor of it. It's a program that was initiated, I believe, by the Superior Court. What makes you think it'll work, and kind of outline it for us?
Well, really, we're talking about a handful of individuals. The health department, and Joe is here representing our outstanding Department of Public Health, has analyzed the fact that the top 225 users of multiple systems, our most serious chronic inebriates, are costing the city $13.5 million in emergency and other services, and it's not productive money being spent. And within this grouping, there's probably a subset of less than 70 individuals who have a high number of failures to appear. They're individuals whose chronic alcoholism has not only debilitated them physically and mentally, but it's also caused them to be cited. And with the failures to appear, the court has the right to engage in a civil contempt process. I'm in dangerous territory trying to out-legal Jeff Adachi, and I know he'll help correct me here. But the court has the right to do its own filing and bring in an individual. And I think we're really talking about a handful of individuals, because while these folks seem pretty tough on the street and create a lot of mayhem, really they're physically very damaged inside. And so the courts would bring them in based on this failure to appear, and has the right to cite jail time, and that would allow the health department to work with them. We envision that these individuals are probably going to not go to jail initially, but go to SF General, because they're going to have underlying conditions that are going to be very dangerous to their health. But as they stabilize, the health department will be able to work with them while in custody and hopefully could agree to a treatment plan. One of the major differences is that there are individuals who do clean up going through our sobering center, but they have the right to just get up and walk out at any time. And for these individuals, this handful of people, it's really not good for our city. It's not good for them. And we hope that we can work out, by sobering them over a sustained period of time, the ability to have them go into treatment. But if they leave, they are liable for violating a court order.
And this is a pilot program that's, at least according to reports by Maturin Ross, ready to go in about 30 days or so?
I'll defer to Joe.
We're ready to go whenever the mayor tells us to go. We're going to provide a continuum of care for these individuals. We have a history, a longstanding history of working with the courts in what are called collaborative courts, things like behavioral health court, drug court, and the community justice center, where we work with the attorneys, where we work with the judges, we work with the individual defendant, and community mental health, behavioral health providers to assess and provide whatever the needed services are. So,
but this would be compulsory, and I'm assuming that the resources are there. San Francisco General could pretty much take care of this because of the small number you're talking about.
And we don't anticipate that their stays will be long at San Francisco General. If the individual health needs are too severe for jail health services to maintain them in the jail, they'll go over to General, either be cleared or admitted to the hospital. If they're cleared, then they'll be brought back to the jail for admission.
How much option do they have in terms of, can they get residential treatment by?
Their treatment plans will be worked out, and the courts have said, mm-hmm. the presiding judge has said that she's looking to the Department of Public Health mm-hmm. to be those experts to really define it. And Judge Garrett Wong, who is the judge that oversees the behavioral health court, he's going to hear these cases, and the PD and the DA work currently through the behavioral health court. But in this instance, it'll only be the public defender that will be representing individuals that are brought in there. And I think that Judge Wong is someone who's really expert and has really learned a lot and can stipulate a treatment program and protocol that I think is going to be really helpful for these individuals.
But the public defender has some concerns about due process, don't you, Jeff Adachi?
Right. I was surprised to hear about this because we were not brought in. The public defender's office was not contacted, and we just learned about it and said, oh, we're going to start this in a couple weeks. And when we've done these other collaborative courts in the past, what we've done, we sat down and we figured out, well, how do we do this consistent with our Constitution? What's happening here is that they're basically going to go out and arrest people for crimes and then use their failure to appear in court as a justification to give them long jail sentences. And so it's really selective enforcement of a particular subset of people with a disease. And the justification being that the disease, alcoholism, costs the city money. Well, so does type 2 diabetes. I mean, should we cut off diabetics' access to sweets and jail them and force them to lose weight? This is
you're a big cost savings guy. I mean, pension plan, we're talking about millions of dollars here.
Yeah, and we don't want to waste more money. And I've looked at studies, and you know, Bevin has talked about this idea of, you know, a wet house where alcoholics can go and freely use alcohol. It's a harm reduction model. That's something I favor very much. This, to me, goes in the wrong direction because essentially what you're doing is you're using the jails to mandate alcohol treatment. You're keeping people in custody, and there's really no sustainable plan once they get out. And so you're keeping a person in jail, say, for 5 or 10 days. What happens afterwards? There's no plan. There's no money. There's no support. That's my concern. We don't need to waste money. I think what we need to do is look at what's worked in other places. And I'm really in favor of trying, you know, this idea of a wet house. I think it's a good idea, and I think that this really takes away from that.
Now, what about the concerns you're hearing from Jeff Adachi? Let me go back to you, Bevin Dufty, or Joe Robinson. I mean, how would you address them? And what about your idea, Bevin, of a wet house? Let's take that first.
Well, we just took our third trip to Seattle. Joe actually has been with me to visit the wet house, and I'm very hopeful that in 2013, with the mayor's support, I appreciate Jeff's support. I think it is really the pinnacle of harm reduction housing. And in Seattle, the first year that they opened the wet house with 75 units of housing, they saved $4 million. And I can tell you from going there, I've seen people that have been there for the 3 years that I've been visiting this facility. And we're not on a one-track approach, and I'm proud of the fact that I have fought and pushed and cajoled and continue to advocate for wet housing, and I think that it'll happen. But when Jeff points out that we're talking about significant jail time, it's less than 6 months, and I would say that if you are raising a family in the Tenderloin or you live on Haight Street, that there are a handful of individuals, and this is not a wholesale program. This is not a program where you're going to see 15, 20, 40 people picked up. I think we're really wanting to learn how to deal with one of the most difficult populations in our city, and I think that we do have something to learn, and I think we should be proud of the fact that a lot of departments have come together and said, look, we're tired of the current situation. We're tired of just cycling people in and out of services, and I think it's a fair criticism on Jeff's part that we should sit down more with the public defender, and I think that we should spend that time over the next 2 to 3 weeks so that he feels as comfortable as possible. Ultimately, I think Jeff does a great job, and I think he will do an excellent job of representing the interests of these individuals in the court. But 40% of the civil cases in San Francisco are court trial versus jury trial. And so I think that this is not unusual. And I think that the judges are going to be very mindful of what the issues are here. But I think that it's our responsibility to try and do things differently. And that's what I've tried to suggest at HOPE. And I think that this is an example of coming together, focusing on a very hardcore population that is creating a lot of destruction for themselves and for their neighborhoods, and seeing if we can do better.
Well, Mayor Lee said 68 people are, he threw out that figure, are costing the city of San Francisco millions of dollars. But Jeff Adachi, you also have concerns that this is a kind of selective enforcement and that the jails perhaps aren't really ready to handle the kind of rehabilitation program we're talking about.
Well, one day in a county jail costs about $140. So for a six-month sentence, you're talking about $18,000. And what troubles me even more is that the alcoholic, when he gets out or she gets out, is going to start drinking again. We know that. We've seen that. And so with, you know, this estimated 225 chronic inebriates on the streets, I mean, that hardly sounds like it's going to be a cost savings. But I have a stack of studies here that have found substantial cost savings as well as a reduction in providing, you know, supportive housing where people, you know, are not prohibited from drinking. And that's really what's missing here. We need to have supportive housing for folks. Just putting people in jail and warehousing them, we've learned that lesson already, hopefully, and we're starting to reverse that. We have our state realignment process where we're really looking at community alternatives. And so by putting people in jail, in custody, and here you're going to have to create a separate unit because this is a civil commitment. So you can't just throw them in with accused murderers and other folks. So you're going to have to create a separate wing in the jail. You're going to have facilities there to provide this treatment. It's very, very expensive. And at the same time, you know, we're talking about, and Bevin knows this, there are 30 to 90-day waits to get into detox program when you're out of custody. So I can't imagine that, you know, this is ultimately going to result in cost savings for the city. It's going to be expensive, and unfortunately, it's not going to work.
Well, let's bring Dr. Keith Humphries in this, who is an expert on alcohol addiction. I mean, this may get people off the streets, but if there's the assumption that you have someone spending time in jail, it's going to turn into sobriety. That just isn't the case.
No, it's not. I mean, this is a good illustration of a problem of perspective and what different stakeholders want from the same program. So if you take your cat to the vet to be neutered, afterwards you think the cat is fixed. The cat thinks that it's been broken. Right. There's a lot of problems like that where, from a health point of view, we have interest in the person's health, but we also have a public order interest. So let's say you're a merchant in San Francisco. You have a chronically intoxicated person sleeping on your stoop. When they're gone, as far as you're concerned, it's a good program. That may be that they're doing well. It may be they're in jail. Maybe they moved away. It may be that they've passed away. Your problem is solved. That doesn't mean that person is doing well. Short-term jail for people who are addicted just doesn't work, even if there's treatment in the jail. It's a chronic disorder. It's not acute disorder. So it may solve the problem for the people who have to deal with the behavior, which is, you know, difficult and unpleasant, but it will not bring people to recovery.
But with the treatment programs that we have in place, and they're hard to get into, as Jeff Adachi said, there's still questions about the efficacy of those programs in the long term. I mean, people go back on the streets, whether they're homeless or not, or they go back to their old cronies, and they go back to their old habits, and often those habits are simply drinking and drinking chronically. I'm wondering if there are perhaps programs that might be better to be looked at here. I'm not saying that this program shouldn't be tried, coming down with that kind of opinion, but I know there's a program called the Oxford House Program, for example.
Right. I mean, if we are not that good in medicine in general at treating chronic disorders. Medicine is really set up to treat acute things. You know, you break an arm, you come to the hospital, your arm is set, and you go back and you're fine. But when you get into the things like pain, diabetes, and addiction, that particular model doesn't work because people need enduring support. There's no short-term fix. So Oxford House, I think, is something that should be tried, for example. And what that is, it's a peer-managed home run by people in recovery, and you can stay there for the rest of your life if you want to, as long as you don't drink or use drugs. That's a model that's had very good evidence of effectiveness.
There are also different models in Wisconsin and in South Dakota that perhaps we ought to bring into public attention.
Right. Another type of model is to use the power of the court not to force people into treatment, but to use it to force them to stop drinking. So what South Dakota does, if somebody's been arrested for drunk driving five times, a judge will say, you're going to be breathalyzed every single day. And if you are intoxicated, you're going to endure a consequence that day. You spend one night of your sentence in jail. And treatment is offered, but it's not the standard of success. The standard of success is the person stops drinking. And that's had a very strong evidence of effect, and that's why a lot of states are adopting it, including Wisconsin.
Let me bring Joe Robinson back in. This is Director of Community Behavioral Health Services with the San Francisco Department of Health. There has been a good deal of collaboration with the courts in terms of the sort of thing we're talking about here, and some real success stories, no?
That's correct. Both our drug court and our behavioral court and our community justice center has had very good success at reducing incarcerations, at reducing high cost of services, and really getting people stable in their community, stable in their mental health, and more stable with their substance use. One of the things that I understand about this pilot project is that the treatment in jail is really going to be only until we can get them into a community treatment. And the Department of Public Health has a full spectrum of treatment. So a mental health, behavioral health professional will be doing an assessment of the individual and seeing what kind of service plan, what kind of care plan would best help this person. We have a full spectrum of services in the city, from things as like outpatient all the way to supported housing, residential treatment, some residential treatment programs that are out of the community, out of the area that the person is used to getting intoxicated, buying drugs, buying alcohol.
San Francisco remains a model, actually. I mean, a national model for doing this right. But when it comes to alcoholism, and Dr. Humphries, let me defer to you here. I mean, I don't mean to throw a monkey wrench into this, but there seems to be almost a consensus that it is a disease and ought to be treated like a disease, despite the fact that there are people who say, well, calling it a disease, I don't want to get into semantics here, but, you know, makes it suggest that you often hear alcoholics say, well, it's my disease. You know, I crashed and I was drunk, but...
Right. I mean, a disease doesn't mean that you get a blank check for any behavior. I mean, we if somebody is diabetic, we still expect them to check their sugar and, you know, to take insulin, be responsible, not eat in a way that's going to exacerbate their condition. And we can expect that of people who are addicted. What an addict cannot change is the fact that their body has been permanently altered through, you know, repeatedly ingesting psychoactive substances. So they're always at some level going to be at risk for relapse. They're always going to feel a desire for drugs and alcohol that most people don't experience. But we know people can recover. I mean, why are there over a million people in Alcoholics Anonymous? I mean, they are capable of being responsible. So the goal of things like the court that was just described, which is a very good model, is to help people be responsible, give them the resources they need to exercise the control that they can.
We are talking about a very small part of the population here, though, Jeff Adachi. I mean, wouldn't it be worthwhile to just try this on a pilot basis?
Well, see, the problem here is that the way that model is set up is that a person receives a sentence basically into alcohol treatment in the jail. And there's no correlation between changing the person's behavior, i.e. not drinking, and the jail sentence that they receive. And so if you have 12 failures to appear multiplied by 5 days, you're going to be in jail for, say, 60 days.
You're going to get dry, but not sober.
Right, yes. Right. And I've been doing this for 26 years, and I see people, they come in, they dry up. You know, it's like talking to your brother or sister, you know, within a couple of weeks, and then they're let out of jail, and we see the same cycle again and again and again. We need to break that cycle. And so if you're going to create an effective system, to deal with this, there has to be a graduated sanction model, meaning that if a person drinks, there'll be a consequence, but that consequence is going to be correlated to, you know, what the person did. Here, if you're simply saying, oh, you're drinking, you're passed out on the sidewalk, you're going to get 6 months in jail, that's not going to change behavior. You have to interact with the individual. You have to have a, you know, meaningful exchange so they understand what's expected, and at the same time, you know, you're clearly setting out in advance, you know, what's going to happen if certain changes in behavior do not occur.
We're talking about a trajectory not only of consequences, but of behavioral change.
Right, right. And that's really what the court can do. A court can't, you know, wave a magic wand and say, okay, you stop drinking, you know, that's it. The person's going to go out there and start drinking again. That's why this harm reduction model is important. We know that an alcoholic is going to relapse. We know that. That's a fact. And so by expecting the person to suddenly go dry just because they've been held in contempt of court isn't going to work. And the concern I have here is that even if it's, you know, 100 people that they try this on, it's wasted resources when that those resources could be better spent on looking at the harm reduction model like the White House is. There was a 3-year study that was done of the Seattle program, and they found the cost savings, they found the change in behavior. All these things were consistent with what the science supports. And so let's look at the science of making these decisions.
Well, let me get a rejoinder to that, or perhaps some response from either Joe Robinson or Bevan Dufty. You would say what in response to what you just heard from Public Defender?
We are working towards wet housing, and the Journal of Public Health of the AMA had a study that showed that there was a 40% reduction of alcohol consumption on the part of individuals that had lived there 6 months. They went from 22 drinks a day down to 12 drinks a day. But yet and still, you do have a population, and even Seattle does, of individuals who are not willing to avail themselves of services. And Kevin Fagan of the Chronicle, he's done an amazing job over the last 10 years of really writing about homelessness in a different manner, not focusing on criminalizing behavior, not focusing on just get people off of our block. And that's my philosophy. But guess what? When Kevin wrote about this a few weeks ago, and he wrote about the individuals that we're focusing on here, these individuals are incredibly disruptive to people in the city, to their neighborhoods, and they're disruptive to themselves. And they need a timeout. And no, I don't think in any way is the expectation that people are going to become sober. That's not what the expectation is. But once they are cleaned up, once they've had the compulsory treatment, they can make some better choices for themselves. And we have 5,000 units of supportive housing. There are people who are managing addictions that live in supportive housing right now. But there are a handful, and I would say this number 68 that the mayor refers to is a good ballpark figure. And I think we're talking probably about just a handful of cases initially, 1, 2, or 3, to see how it works. And I think that's our responsibility to try things. I think that the points that are being raised here are legitimate ones. And if we were on a single track and simply saying that the court was going to wave a wand and solve all our problems, it would be the right thing. But, Michael, you know what frustrates me? I wish that some of the money that we're wasting here, I wish that Jeff could use it for Mo Magic, because I've seen what his programs have done in the Western Addition to help people. When I read a study from UCSF that of people who are living homeless or marginally housed in the city, 56% have inadequate access to nutrition. That means that they can't take their medicines because it's too debilitating for their bodies. And what does it mean? Twice as likely to be in an ER or a hospitalization. So what I'm suggesting here is we have an amazing public health system, and I think that we can make far better investments than we're doing with these handful of individuals. And let us just try it. I think we're going to be extremely careful, and you're going to see the courts and the city departments working together. So we're not just talking about a 6-month plan. We're hoping to get people in the type of treatment so that they can make better choices. There have been individuals. There's an individual who had hundreds upon hundreds of citations who Matera and Ross used to write about all the time 5 or 6 years ago. This person, as a result of being in jail for a period of time, wound up living in a board and care. And as long as he can smoke, he's happy and staying in his board and care.
Well, I'm going to open our phone lines and also open ways for those of you listening to communicate your thoughts and feelings about not only this proposed plan, but really what to do about, well, the chronic drunkenness that continues to plague this city and other cities throughout. And people are listening to us throughout the country now on Sirius. It's an ongoing problem in not only urban areas, but really small towns as well. What do you do about the chronic drunks and the chronic drunks who don't seem to be able to get off the sauce, as we used to say? Our toll-free number is available to you, and we do welcome your contributions to this conversation. Any questions or comments you have, you can let us know by dialing toll-free 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free. We welcome your calls, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. And, of course, you can also go to our Facebook page and let us know your thoughts that way, or go to Twitter. Our handle is @KQEDForum. We'll hear from you, our listeners, when we return. We're talking to Bevan Dufty from Housing Opportunity Partnerships and Engagement, and Jeff Adachi from the Public Defender's Office, Joe Robinson from the Department of Health, and Keith Humphreys from the Stanford School of Medicine. More when we return. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the problem and what perhaps might be some of the solutions to treatment for chronic drunkenness. There's a proposed program that has been put forward that essentially which is supported by the mayor and a number of public officials, could force chronic drunks to stay in jail or choose mandatory treatment for up to 6 months. And many of these chronic offenders, of course, are homeless. Critics are worrying that it's a short-term solution to a complex problem and violates offenders' rights, and we're pretty much taking this on as well as a whole general question. With us in studio is Joe Robinson, who directs the Community Behavioral Health Services for the San Francisco Department of Public Health, and Jeff Adachi, who is public defender for the City and County of San Francisco, and Keith Humphreys, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford School of Medicine, Bevan Dufty, director of the Housing Opportunity Partnerships and Engagement Program in San Francisco. Just reading some web comments here, quite a range. George writes, when talking about drunkenness laws, I think it's worth looking at European countries for inspiration. Most do not have laws against public intoxication, and their societies don't seem to suffer. It makes sense for people to be jailed if they're being belligerent or causing a scene, but less so for stumbling around and being silly. Beth from up in the Sierras writes, don't you need to look deeper to see why a homeless person stays drunk? What if it's because they have a dental problem and the alcohol dulls the pain? And what if it's because they want to block their pain in general from being dissed by people, dealing with physical abuse, etc.? Would 6 months in rehab be enough? And once they get out of rehab, then what? They have to have hope for a better future. What's the educational level of most of these homeless alcoholics? Amir says, for a great way to come out of all our addictions, check out Vipassana Meditation at dhamma.org, and adds, be happy. And Ginny also writes on our website, please understand the difference between alcoholism and a habit. Those with the obsession have the course of jails, institutions, and death unless they choose to get sober. Please don't underestimate a person's ability to get themselves sober. Harm reduction is not treatment. I believe a six-month spin dry is a worthy effort that offers the alcoholic a moment of clarity to say yes to recovery and accept help. Is San Francisco General ready for this? Remember, a person can die by their alcoholic withdrawals. What would you say to that, Dr. Humphrey?
There is. I worry about that a bit. When people go off of alcohol or any other drug they use regularly, their tolerance drops dramatically. So when they go back out where it's available, you do see a lot of overdoses because they think they can take their normal dose and they can't anymore. And I'm sure that, you know, the health department is aware of this. But that's going to be critically important to make sure this program, which, you know, very well-intended program, is doesn't put people at
any risk.
That's
the kind of psychology says, I'm going to make up for the time I couldn't drink.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's really what it is.
Yeah, well, you see it in jails all the time. I mean, people, you know, are, you know, the day they get out, why so many people go back, a huge number of them, is because they get drunk and they do something stupid and then they're right back in again. So it's the so I'm celebrating in the worst possible way.
Did you want to say something, Joe Robinson?
Yeah. For years, I was the director of jail psychiatric services in the San Francisco jail. And people that are institutionalized in the jail really only receive an institutional sobriety. It's not a recovering kind of sobriety. But and you said this, Jeff, too. You can talk to people, work with them during their incarceration, and most of them are very serious about their recovery. But start seeing a few weeks before their release that starting to wane. Because their behaviors, their disease is so embedded. What we hope for this program is that the community managers, the community treatment providers come into the jail, meet the people while they're in the jail to actually bridge incarceration to treatment.
Let me go to our callers. And we begin with a caller from Portland, Oregon. Andrew, join us. Welcome.
Hi, Michael and guests. I've been in and around the rehab industry, as I'll call it, for about 15 years, and I think it's really time in this country that we expose all of the 12-step programs that are mandated by so many state and city local governments for people to attend for alcohol or drug use. These programs utterly fail because at their core, they have no tools to give people to deal with real life. They ultimately put you in a bubble. And once people are exposed to actual life again, they have no mechanisms to deal with the things that they experience on a daily basis. This is a cognitive disorder, and it's something that has to be dealt with in that way. So, you know, having thinly veiled religious propaganda at the base of what is masquerading in the 12 steps here, it doesn't work except for like a very small percentage of people. And that's based on 12 steps' own triennial survey. The rate of spontaneous remission among alcoholics and addicts is higher than attending these kind of programs. So I want to know what the guests have to say about getting actual cognitive tools in place for people to deal with life on a daily basis and not have to try to avoid it or hang on by their fingernails for a 24-hour period.
Well, let me first get Keith Humphries to weigh in on some of the data that you've placed in front of us here. I mean, let's talk in general about efficacy of 12-step programs.
Yeah, quite an indictment there. But, you know, we make these judgments in healthcare based on randomized clinical trials. And at the Palo Alto VA, my colleague, Dr. Chris Timko, did a randomized trial of referring people who are veterans to AA and NA, and those who were referred used about 60% less drugs and alcohol. So for us, that resolves it. I know there's a lot of emotional feelings and a lot of ideological objections to AA, but from a science point of view, they aren't controversial. It is true that people do deserve a choice, and I'm very sympathetic with people who are forced to go to 12-step groups that have not worked for them, and then a judge forces them to go back. It is good to have a range of options because addicts are diverse, but 12 steps, you know, are a solid thing to do.
And he mentioned the religious nature of 12 steps. Sometimes people get sober because of religion too. I mean, it can be
people get sober for lots of reasons. Yeah. That's why I think that, you know, it's not just treatment that gets people sober. There's lots of things.
Michael,
let me just ask Joel Robinson quickly though about because a listener asked about cognitive tools once somebody is out of treatment.
Well, so when they're in treatment, they try to teach them, expose them to cognitive treatments. We use cognitive behavioral therapy. We use motivational interviewing, many best practices to work with the individual so that we can help them find what will help their recovery. Again, everyone's recovery is different, and I think that's something that's very important to remember.
Nijia Fadachi.
Would you, you know, Joe Robinson had mentioned earlier the drug court program we have in San Francisco, and it's one of the models for the country. But the way it works is we don't throw people in jail hoping that they're going to be sober. Instead, what we do is we let them out of jail. We have them engaged in therapeutic treatment and counseling and other forms of harm reduction. And it's a lengthy process. It can take as long as two and a half years. And let me tell you, it's a very torturous road for people who decide to do it, but it's been very successful. And the reason why it's successful is because people are essentially rewarded by not being in jail for you know, to not use drugs. What this model does is just the opposite. It puts them in jail. It puts them in jail for a period of time. As far as I can see, there doesn't seem to be any sustainable plan once they get out of jail. And what the caller said, unfortunately, is true, that if you don't have a plan for these folks when they get out, they're going to go back to their old environment. They're going to start drinking. They're going to be on the same corners. And, you know, we're simply going to be taking them out of circulation for whatever time that they're in jail. But they'll be back. And that's the reality.
Let me get some of our other callers on. Brian, join us. You're on.
Hi. Yeah, my name's Brian. I am an alcoholic recovery person. I'm also a small business person that lives in Union Square. And I was very happy to see this article in the paper and the fact that the city is exploring this opportunity. I mean, if you're an alcoholic, you know that, you know, you either stop drinking or you die. And it's, you know, it's criminal for us to let people die on the streets of San Francisco without intervening. And using the criminal justice system as a bridge to community-based programs is the way to go. But in this article in the paper, it said that there's 68 people that, you know, Ed Lee knows about that is costing the city, you know, millions of dollars. So, you know, we should focus in on these 68 people who are going to die on the streets of San Francisco if, you know, they don't get some, you know, intervention from the criminal justice system. And then they should be, you know, given a choice, a bridge to 12-step programs, to Glide, to Delancey Street, to Walden House, to vocational training, to a wet house, to this Oxford program, whatever. But, you know, you can't ignore the problem and let these, you know, these 68 people or these 100 people or whatever just die on the streets of San Francisco because they won't stop. And unless they stop, they're going to die. That's just the reality.
You know? Brian, I thank you for your calls. I appreciate the call. And if listeners are wondering where do all these costs come from, just think of the ambulance costs, for example, let alone treatment and care. It really does amount to millions of dollars. I want to get another caller on. Stephen, that's you. Hi.
Yes. Hi, this is Stephen. I'm also a recovering alcoholic, and I've been through the criminal justice system in San Francisco because of it. And there's so many issues you guys are covering this morning. It's hard to keep track of them all. We're talking about harm reduction. We're talking about, you know, drug diversion. We're talking about treatment. We're talking about getting drunks off the street, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All I have to say is, having been through several treatment programs myself, in and out of jail, et cetera, I don't really believe in harm reduction. There is no such thing. The most harm reduction you can do is to treat the drug addict or alcoholic. You know, they could do 30, 60, 90 days. Doesn't matter. If they don't have aftercare, then there's no such thing as harm reduction. There's no harm has been reduced. And, you know, I know from being in and out of programs and in and out of jail for alcoholism that, like, no matter what, I constantly needed treatment, whether it was through Walden House, whether it was through AA or both. I'm currently an outpatient, and I do AA, and that's almost not enough. And I appreciate Adachi's office and what they've done to work with San Francisco and the fact that they do have drug diversion programs that try to keep us out of jail.
Now, what do you think, Bevan Duffy, when you hear a caller like Stephen say there is no such thing as harm reduction?
Well, I'm very moved by Stephen's call, and I think it shows the magnitude of what we're dealing with. You know, someone that's expressing their life and appreciation for services they've offered, expressing appreciation for the representation that they've received from the public defender, and yet and still struggling. I think that harm reduction has been proven in San Francisco. You look at needle exchange and what we've accomplished in San Francisco. We're a model to the country, saying that if people are going to be injection drug users, that they should have access to clean needles. I carry the legislation so that individuals can purchase syringes from any drugstore and not have to have a prescription for that. And the result of that has been that we have one of the lowest transmission rates of HIV for injection drug users. So I'm sorry, and I appreciate what Stephen is sharing, I think, is very relevant and real for him. But I think that harm reduction has a place. But I think, again, we're taking a lot of time here talking about a handful of people. And what we're really going to do is the city is going to try and come together. And maybe it's late, but we're going to invite Jeff to the party here and really try and work together and see if we can do something meaningful for a handful of people.
No alcohol at that party, please, by the way.
It'll be a dry party, I guess.
Let me thank the caller and move on to more of your calls. Michael, join us. Hi.
Hi, this is Michael from San Francisco. You know, I'm an ER doctor, and I deal with these chronic inebriates every day of my work. These people are chronically suicidal, and the discussion of their individual rights and recovery is, in my mind, naive. We are abandoning these people by allowing them back onto the streets. They cannot take care of themselves. They are harming themselves, and they are harming others. They are victims of violent crime on a daily basis. And to say, hey, let's make sure we protect their rights is a disservice to them. Let's lock them up, put them in a wet house situation or other type of controlled environment where they can't harm the rest of the community and continue to harm themselves as much as they already are.
Hi, Dr. Michael. I thank you for the call. Jeff Adachi.
I just want to note one thing, that there is a process now, I don't know if the doctor's aware of this, where people can be, you know, taken to the hospital and kept involuntarily. It's called a 5150. And if you're a danger to yourself or to others, and the doctor mentioned that he sees people who are suicidal, you can be involuntarily placed in the hospital. It happens all the time. And we actually have a mental health unit that works with many individuals who are mentally ill, who are chronic inebriates. There's also something that's called a conservatorship, and a person can be conserved. And they can be conserved if they're killing themselves with alcohol. We do have cases which are brought to court, and these individuals are mandated into treatment. The problem is that if you're going to start arresting people and putting them in jail for treatment, under our Constitution, they have to have committed a crime. You know, we could stop obesity by arresting people and putting them in jail so they don't eat. But again, they haven't committed a crime. So, you know, there's that tension, obviously, between the Constitution and people's right to exercise their free will. And I think that's something that has to be acknowledged.
Well, as one of the earlier callers said, we've been talking about a wide range of issues here, even just concentrating on the small number of people. But I'm thinking of I need to ask this of you, Keith Humphreys, apropos of the last call. Thinking of a movie portrayal like the one in Leaving Las Vegas, there does seem to be a propensity of some of these people to really literally want to drink themselves to death. I mean, is it a suicidal mission almost?
Actually, alcoholism is the biggest risk factor for suicide. It's not depression. It's alcoholism. The highest rate of attempts and the highest rate of succeeding. And, you know, quite a few – if you follow back the life histories of these people, that you know, that alcohol is not the first problem that they've had. And many of them come from very, you know, painful family backgrounds. They've had – some had experience – you know, we have veterans experience of combat and war. So they're often very, very damaged and unhappy. And alcohol is one of their problems, but it's not the only one.
Let me go to another caller up in Washington State. Ray, you're on. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to talk about, again, you know, this conversation has been really focused towards a really small number of people in society. I tend to have the view that there are many, many more people that don't quite take the fall over the edge into super severe alcoholism or drug, you know, a drug addiction. And the majority of the people that use are kind of coping and managing and living their normal lives. I come from an experience where I had to serve out a court-mandated drug treatment session, some, you know, time in jail, things like that, for a marijuana possession charge. But while I was going through the experience, you kind of get lumped in with just everybody, alcoholics, heroin users, you know, things like that when you go through these treatments. And the one observation that I really had was that twofold, the treatment that you receive when you go through this sort of thing is really, really focused on getting you in and out the door 7-Eleven style. And there is no mechanism for follow-up for there's no method mechanism for, you know, if you just want more information, if you just want some of that support without maybe paying $200 a week, you know, after your treatment is done. And so it really makes a lot of the patients I talk to feel like they are a checkbook, you know, not somebody that needs help or that needs to be maybe given a little bit of a buffer so they don't fall off that edge. Instead, they're treated like a number on a list, and they get in and out, and they pay their money, and they move on with their life, and it isn't actually a help. So I really feel like a big focus needs to be on providing just some of the support to anybody that could want it, anyone that feels like it could be necessary, that really is focused on, you know, you instead of your checkbook.
All right, Ray, I thank you for your comments. Let me go to some more comments from listeners coming to us via email. Here's a listener who writes, "My name is Kathleen. I've been an ER nurse for almost 20 years and have cared for many drunks. Most of the time, these patients are brought in by ambulance and require a pretty pricey workup, IV fluids, CT of head, etc. Most of these patients come back time and time again. Some say they want to get cleaned up. Some say they don't. I think a wet house is the way to go and more resources for those who want to get clean. I have been saddened deeply when I have cared for a drunk who, once sobered up, expresses the desire to go into rehab, but it is in the middle of the night and there's no place to send him or her. It breaks my heart. We need more services for people like this." Richard writes, "The two proposals that are being put in opposition really seem like two halves of a solution. Supportive housing is what we'll do to help you. Incarceration is what we'll do if you choose not to be responsive, leave, or accept treatment. You would expect these two tools together to deliver better results than either one by itself, measured by how much the public spends, what quality of life indigents have, and how much destructive impact the indigents have on the public." And Rick on our Facebook page comments, "You're drinking, you're intoxicated, you're passed out on the sidewalk, you're going to spend 6 months in jail, but you're not going to address the issue of chronic alcoholism. Yes, but that's 6 months of the alcoholic not on my stoop or passed out on my sidewalk. As citizens, must we hold ourselves individually responsible for the alcohol habits of such a small subset of our community when they so clearly are not even held to the standard of showing up for their court dates?" Anybody want to comment on that?
Well, I think these are individuals that Kevin, there are some of them that have had 20 failures to appear at the court following a citation by a police officer this year. And I think the 68 number refers to, I think, a population over 2 years that have had failures to appear. And so I think that these are individuals who are consistently breaking the law and coming into conflict with their neighborhood because of their alcohol addiction. And I think that this, again, is a pilot. This is something that we're going to work at slowly. I appreciate the comment where someone said that there are two halves of a whole solution. And I think that supportive housing, expanding supportive housing, the Board of Supervisors this year provided $3 million in additional funds for our shelter and homeless resource centers. So we recognize that we need to improve those services so that people will avail themselves of those services. But I definitely think that this is a step that we need to cooperatively try and take and to see and to learn from it. And I think you can count on our world-class Department of Public Health to do things that are the best interest of the individual, to be very focused on their health and medical condition, and to really look at the results of this and say whether this is a way to go for a subset of this population or whether we need to try something different.
It's important to note
that public
intoxication is a crime in California. It's Penal Code Section 647F. And if a person is charged with that crime and is convicted, and you have a right to a jury trial because you're facing incarceration and a right to have a lawyer, then you can serve 6 months in the county jail or be placed on probation. What we're talking about here is essentially jailing people for failing to show up for court. And most people who fail to show up for court, and it's not only chronic inebriates, there are a lot of people, unfortunately, who don't show up for courts, especially on citations and misdemeanors. But if we're going to start jailing people for 5 days for not showing up on traffic tickets and everything else, we had to do it fairly and impose that on everyone, not just people who have drinking problems. So I think that it's really a question of, one, the process and whether or not we have a way of getting these people to treatment, which violates their basic rights. And, of course, somebody who is passed out on the sidewalk is probably not that concerned about their constitutional rights. But it's something that, you know, in this country we happen to have. And though it's an inconvenience sometimes, it's something that we have to tolerate.
And you're listening to Forum. We're talking to Jeff Adachi, Brian Dufty, Joe Robinson, and Keith Humphreys. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, do go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to more of your calls. And Amy, you're up next here. Welcome, Amy.
Hi, thank you. My husband and I own a business on 6th and Folsom, and I think Mr. Humphreys is living in a fantasy world. I mean, I'm sorry, but it is not someone's right to leave them on the street, to let them fend for themselves when they're obviously so completely beyond any every day. We deal with this, and at least once a week, we see the resources that are put into this by the paramedics that pull up in front of our businesses to get people out of the street so they're not run over, who are being belligerent to other people. This would never be allowed in other neighborhoods of San Francisco. So the solution is to just let it happen south of Market to in the Tenderloin where it's just rampant. And these people, I'm sorry, there are other people that have rights in this city, and it's called the people who pay the taxes, who have businesses, who are trying to live their daily life. It is not to the benefit of these poor people to leave them out there. And I'm sorry.
Wait, forgive me, Amy. I'm not sure why you're taking Keith Humphreys to task here. What did he say?
Because he and Jeff Adachi, I'm sorry, their whole thing is the rights of these people, that we're taking the rights away from these people, and the resources that are going to go into it. $15 million, I think, is probably very low as to how much it's cost for these chronic people to keep getting picked up over and over and over again. And he's talking about the fact that, oh, it's their right to be on the street drunk and passed out. I'm sorry. I do take exception to that. That's not right for them, and it's not right for people who are trying to live their life in a civilized city.
I think Public Defender Adachi wants to respond.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't think anyone is saying let's not do anything. In fact, you know, we work with this population of folks all the time because they are in and out of the criminal justice system. The question is, what works? What's going to get them off the street? If we manage to get them off the street for 5 days, does that provide relief? Sure. But what if they're back? And if we're looking at really long-term sustainable solutions, and this is something that the city has talked about, but it really, you know, hasn't looked at, putting together a comprehensive model for some time. And The other thing that the city hasn't done, it hasn't been consistent in their approach. I mean, we had a mobile unit for a while that would go out and respond and provide services. You know, now we're talking about this wet house idea. And so we're constantly shifting strategies. And I agree that something needs to be done, that we don't want a society where people just are allowed to die. None of us are advocating for that. But what we're saying is let's invest in a model that's going to work, that's going to produce long-term results, and that's ultimately going to be sustainable for both the community, which is suffering harm from having people disrupt their lives, and also the individual who is suffering from alcoholism, which unfortunately is a disease.
All right. Before I go to more calls, I wanted to bring in some of the emails. Actually, bring in a tweet here. A listener tweets, if 68 million people cost millions of dollars, San Francisco could get 68 people housing, medical insurance, and other services and save money. Another listener writes, as a case manager who works in a wet subsidized housing facility in Soma, south of Market, I must disagree with the notion to consequent chronic alcoholics with the prospect of jail should they choose not to participate in a drug and alcohol treatment program. The city has many hundreds of social service providers on whom they can rely to try to get these individuals into treatment. Using consequences to guide someone's decision-making doesn't make it a better person of an alcoholic. All it does is make it wrong when the chronic alcoholic gets caught. Why can't the city utilize the social service providers in a community outreach effort in an attempt to persuade these individuals to get help via treatment modalities? I think arrests, jail, prosecution, and incarceration are all a waste of time, money, and resources. The resources are here. Why not use? Train us in effective community outreach. Doing so allows the police to focus on more serious crimes. It frees up the courts and jails. Joe Robinson, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, we do work at effective community outreach. We do have mobile teams that stop and have conversations or attempt to have conversations of these individuals to engage them in care. It's our hope, too. We really want to get people into appropriate community services. We also recognize that if people aren't on the street, if they're appropriately housed, they're not going to be disturbing the community. If you or I were to get drunk in our own home and we didn't do anything to break the law, no one would know. So getting people housed and getting them in supportive housing is really one of the things that I think all of us in this room agree with.
Well, on that note of agreement and hope, we'll have to conclude because the clock has caught us here. I want to thank you, Joe Robinson from the San Francisco Department of Health. Thanks to Jeff Adachi, public defender of San Francisco, and Bevan Dufty from the Housing Opportunity Partnership and Engagement in San Francisco, and Keith Humphreys, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.